Welcome to IT.
Welcome to IT. We are excited to be diving into the world of ophthalmic telemedicine and hearing from experts on what the future of ophthalmic telemedicine looks like. My name is Gagan Kalra, and I am a research fellow at the Cole Eye Institute at Cleveland Clinic. And we are joined by the bright and diligent members of the IT team, whom I'll ask to introduce themselves. Tell us where you're calling from and what your interests are. Catherine.
Sure. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I'm calling from Miami. I currently work in corneal research, and I'm excited to be here after such an amazing time at AAO.
Hey, thanks, Catherine. It's awesome to be here. My name is Mike Zane, and I'm an ocular surface oncology research fellow at the Bascom Palmer Institute. I'm calling from Miami, and some of my interests include global ophthalmology, mentorship in the field, and diversity and equity.
Wonderful. So I will go ahead and introduce our first guest. And our first guest really needs no introduction. Dr. Michael F. Chang is the director of the National Eye Institute at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. And his clinical practice focuses on pediatric ophthalmology and strabismus. He is a board-certified expert in clinical informatics. His research develops and applies biomedical informatics methods to clinical ophthalmology in areas such as retinopathy of prematurity, telehealth, artificial intelligence, clinical information systems, genotype-phenotype correlations, and data analytics. His group has published more than 200 peer-reviewed papers and has developed assistive artificial intelligence system for IOP that received breakthrough status from the US FDA. He has served as a member of the American Academy of Ophthalmology Board of Trustees, chair of the AAO Iris Registry Data Analytics Committee, chair of the AAO Task Force on Artificial Intelligence, chair of AAO Medical Information Technology Committee, and on several other national and local committees. He also serves on the editorial board of several internationally acclaimed scientific journals, including the Journal of American Association of Pediatric Ophthalmology and Strabismus, Ophthalmology and Ophthalmology Retina. Hey, Dr. Chang, thank you for making time and joining today.
Well, Gagan, thanks for the introduction. And, you know, I'm really glad to be here and, you know, love that people, especially who are young and talented, are interested in doing ophthalmic telemedicine. Good to hear you. And it was nice to meet you in person.
It was nice to meet you in person as well. It's a pleasure having you here. All right. With that, pass on the mic to Grayson. Give him a chance to introduce our second panelist.
Thanks, Gagan. I have the introduction of Ted Lay, an ophthalmologist and talented surgeon based out of Stanford. He's considered one of the top worldwide innovators in the field of medical and surgical retina. And he also serves as the director of clinical and translational research and the director of ophthalmic diagnostics at Stanford. He did a lot of his training at Stanford, including his medical degree, before going to Bascom Palmer Eye Institute for residency. He then returned to Stanford for his fellowship in vitreoretinal disease and surgery, where he remains on faculty to this day. He's an incredibly talented scientist on top of all of his clinical work, and he's published over 200 peer-reviewed publications. His research has contributed to the field of automated AI for detecting blinding retinal disease and more. And it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Hey there, everyone. Thank you so much for having me and for this kind introduction, Grayson, and for the invitation, Gagan. I like the fact that we all have these overlapping connections and, you know, two people in Miami where I spent a lot of my training and is a very dear part of my life. And I am broadcasting from the Palo Alto area in California. And we might be getting Eddie Corote on as another guest. He's having some technical issues getting into the app. He's reinstalling right now. So hopefully he'll be able to sign on in a few minutes.
Well, thanks for troubleshooting at the back end there, Dr. Lang. I appreciate it. I think with that, we are ready to just kick off our first theme of the day, which is basically the background and where we are with ophthalmic telemedicine. So I'd just like to start off by asking you guys about, you know, telling us a little bit about your journey and how you got involved with telemedicine and ophthalmology, and how have you seen this field evolve in the multiple years of your guys' career? So we can start off by asking Dr. Chang.
Well, yeah, sure, Gagan. I suspect that I'm sadly one of the older people in the room here. And so when I got involved in this field started, well, let me just sort of start from the beginning. I'm an engineer by background, and I always thought the reason I went into medicine is that I thought I would build devices and use them in, you know, validate and sort of test them in people to try to, you know, take better care of patients. And so as a resident, you know, I'll skip sort of how I ended up deciding what I do and how I ended up going into ophthalmology. But as a resident, this was 1997 to 2000, information technology was kind of starting to become mainstream. And, all medical records were paper-based. And, what I really started to wonder is, maybe we don't need more people to build devices. Maybe we need people to manage data and, figure out how to take care of patients better with data management. And so that got me into the field of informatics. And, I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist, and I wanted to do something that melded pediatric ophthalmology with information technology. And I met somebody who was a telemedicine expert. And then, Ted, I know a couple of you are from Bascom. I met somebody named John Flynn, who was actually one of the founding ophthalmologists at Bascom. He'd spent 35 years there and then moved to Columbia, a university, toward the latter part of his career. And he was a world expert in ROP. And just from combining those, I thought I could begin my career in telemedicine for ROP. And so that was the topic of my first major grant. And it's how I really started my career.
It's hard to know where to start. We all go into medicine with altruistic motives and wanting to improve the lives of many people and potentially exponential amount of people. And I think, as a medical student or as a pre-med at a very intense research organization of Stanford University, there is a lot of opportunities, which are wonderful, to get involved in research early on. And like many pre-meds and medical students, I started out in a laboratory doing basic research, try to elucidate pathways in the nervous system of retinal ganglion cells and other aspects. And, what I think I learned for myself over time is that I wanted to make an impact not by knowledge discovery, which was a more traditional pathway of science at the time, but actually the application of knowledge that was already existing. And, this was around the year 2000. So, over 20 years ago now. And at that time, in academic circles, if you weren't creating knowledge, the quote real scientists weren't taking you seriously. I had a lot of mentors in medical school that were, PhDs and MD PhDs, and they always posited, what is the question you're trying to answer when you're doing research? How does this cell work? What are the molecular intricacies of DNA recombination? Questions like that, which are all really, really impactful and valid questions. But I really didn't see myself trying to answer more questions like that, trying to discover the mysteries of the universe. I actually wanted to take the amazing things that my colleagues had discovered and then figure out a way to apply that knowledge and improve the lives of people around me. So, my focus was always on translational medicine before the term was even coined. I really wanted to apply knowledge in unique ways and really improve the lives of others. And, we founded one of the first ophthalmic engineering laboratories, tissue engineering laboratories at Stanford when I was in medical school. And, I think telemedicine is just an extension of that idea. We have the building blocks of being able to take care of people remotely and on scale. We have cameras to take photos. We have virtual ways of communicating with people, and we have people, experts on the other end to do the clinical determinations, and the key here with telemedicine is how to put all these pieces together and actually make a system that can work and be sustained.
The fact that you guys had such interesting, unique paths to get into this field really speaks to the fact that you guys had to innovate to make it to where you are today. And so I just want to thank you guys for blazing a trail for some other people like ourselves to follow. And so I wanted to talk about the second theme today, which is the interaction between technology and society. For people who just joined the room recently, we're talking with Dr. Michael Chang and Ted Lang, two experts in the field of ophthalmic telemedicine. So my question is the following, and I wanted to give a little bit of background first. We all know that during the beginning of the COVID pandemic, many practices tried to switch to telemedical care delivery, but ophthalmology was one of the least prepared to do so. And as soon as things started to swing back towards normal, everything really went back to in-person care for the majority. What do you think some of the barriers are to telemedicine in the adoption of ophthalmology?
I'd be more than happy to answer that. You know, I think the big elephant in the room with telemedicine in general and teleophthalmology specifically is that, you know, I think it's great to create technologies and innovations that work and can help people, but how do you make a sustainable model out of it? Meaning, how do you bring it to the market and make a successful business? And in order for that to happen, there's two main barriers. One is a regulatory barrier, meaning the FDA needs to certify pieces or the whole system that you're using. If you're going to be using things that are, you know, deemed to be medical devices, or now is software as a medical device, or SAMD. And the other kind of big barrier to entry is a payment system. You know, how are we going to pay for this service that's emerging and very exciting? You know, is there a procedural CPT code that can be charged to insurance, and are the insurance going to pay for it? And I think, and Mike can talk about this, you know, in pediatric ROP, and another big area that teleophthalmology has been used for, diabetic retinopathy screening, and maybe in the future glaucoma screening and macular degeneration screening. But it, you know, up until, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, there was no way to actually fund anything that was innovative. You know, of course there are grants that you can do pilots on, but there's nothing that would be sustainable as far as a health system is concerned. And so, you know, I think those are the kind of two big, you know, not so sexy parts of doing medicine, right? How are you going to pay for it, and how are you going to get it approved by the government, that are critical to getting any of these technologies to be widely distributed and used as a kind of a standard of care in healthcare. So I just want to throw that out there for further discussion, but, you know, maybe Mike has some more input on that.
Ted, I think those are all great points. You talked about a sustainable model, and 100% agree. If I were to translate that into sort of, I guess, research terms, if you will, I think that there's a burden on the community to prove that these telemedicine models, number one, are clinically effective. In other words, they work, and hopefully even are better, you know, than the way we currently do things. And number two, that they're cost effective, you know, because the doctors won't start to use something unless it's clinically effective, and the insurers won't start to pay for something. In other words, it's not going to make its way into policy unless it's cost effective. And I think that, you know, Grayson, to get to your questions, in terms, I guess you asked about barriers. I think that there's a lot of barriers. One of them is that we collect data. You know, ophthalmologists make diagnoses using visualizing the structure of the eye. And you can do that with an ophthalmoscope, with OCT, you know, any other sort of, you know, imaging modalities. And right now, I don't know that there's a great way to do that, you know, outside the doctor's office, outside the ophthalmologist's office. And so I think that's a little bit of a chicken egg thing, because we've got to develop devices to do that. But sometimes the vendors may not want to develop those devices if there's not a business model, you know, as Ted said, to pay for them. And so I think that's something that has to be solved. Another thing that I think is important to think about is, you know, Ted mentioned FDA, and FDA is really focused on this concept of indications for use. And I think that's really important. That seems like it's such a simple term, but there's a lot of complexity underneath it. It's like, where are you going to use this device, the system of care? And like, how is it going to fit within the care process? You know, let me give a quick anecdote, and I'll, you know, stop talking. That in terms of barriers, you know, in the 1960s, you know, Grace, I know you're in Boston, and, you know, we've talked about this a little bit, that the airport there, Logan Airport, there was a telemedicine system that was set up between Logan Airport and Massachusetts General Hospital. And this is 1960s technology. I don't know if it was microwave technology or satellite, but, you know, the idea is that if a patient got sick at the airport, there would be a doctor based at the hospital, a doctor with a nurse. They would basically work up the patient there, and then they would have a real-time video stream that went to the Mass General, and the subspecialist at the Mass General would communicate with the doctor or nurse at the airport and the patient who were there. And they made diagnoses, and it actually worked very well medically. But the problem is that, as Ted mentioned, it was not economically self-sustaining, and there was no workflow that could go around that. You had to get a local doctor or nurse, you had to get a patient, you had to get a subspecialist kind of present at the same time to look at things. And, these doctors at MGH, it's not like they don't have anything else to do, doing real-time telemedicine consults. And so I think that some of the telemedicine programs that I see in 2021 sound a little bit like Logan Airport 1960s, where they're not going to work, in the real world because of those workflow, type things. Who's going to schedule them and get them in the same place at the same time? And so I think that's going to be something important to keep in mind for those of you who are interested. How are you going to develop technologies that actually are going to work in the real world? And, just because the real world is the way it is now, I hope that people can think outside the box and envision something, but it's got to be something that's practical.
That's incredibly enlightening. I think you're right. There's so many barriers, and what you guys touched on were probably just the tip of the iceberg too. And, if we can try to fix it in 1960, if we can hopefully try to continue to work on that today. And I hope people can prove out the clinical and cost effectiveness of these models of care. I'll pass it over to Catherine now for the next question. And
can I just add one more thanks? Thanks for having me, first of all. I just want to add that, in addition to all those barriers that were already mentioned, clinicians, for better or worse, are pretty risk averse. And another barrier, I think, is just the status quo. When technologies come to market, even after they're properly validated and approved and have a payment model, a lot of times the uptake isn't necessarily there. For example, from the surgical side, the ingenuity that a lot of retina specialists have seen, it's the heads up display that you can operate through the 3D TV instead of through the scope. And people just generally are averse to new ways of doing things that they've been so ingrained with through their training and careers. And I think so the status quo is a big barrier. And I know that depending on the efficiency of your triage mechanisms, there's definitely established models for this. I mean, at Moorfields, I have a friend that is a Moorfields physician, that's the big eye hospital in the UK for those that don't know, but he lives in Croatia, and he does a full medical retina teleclinic 3 days a week from Croatia, where he has the imaging pulled up, the techs exam, the pertinent positives from there, and is able to make a diagnosis or triage them to further exam. So, beyond the status quo, I think having a good workflow, having a good triage system to put patients into that workflow is really important. And once it's there, you can actually help the patients have a great experience. So.
Thanks for answering that. I actually wanted to introduce Dr. Farhat. So speaking of ophthalmic devices, Dr. Eddie Farhat has helped develop head-mounted surgical displays with Avigant to adapt their wearable retinal projection displays for use in ophthalmic microsurgery. As a TED Med frontline scholar in medical school, Dr. Farhat worked on algorithmic image analysis and is keen on developing point-of-care technologies to improve the lives of patients. He's a current Vidura Retinal Fellow at Stanford Byers Eye Institute and has completed a clinical research fellowship at UCL Moorfields with a grant for applied automated machine learning. He's also worked with Google Health with a focus on global validation of ophthalmic deep learning algorithms for clinical use. He has a deep interest in medical AI safety, quantifying model uncertainty, AI-driven pharmaceutical trial recruitment, and user interface research. He's now leading light in the application of algorithms and AI to the science, disease, and ophthalmic images. So thank you, Dr. Farhat. Anything else you'd like to add to that?
Oh, thanks for the kind introduction, Catherine. Yeah, I think you basically hit all the points. So I'll just contribute where I...
Wonderful. Gagan, if you'd like to go ahead and ask the next question.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here. I'm glad you were able to join, Dr. Farhat. So the next question is actually something that is really relevant. And it's basically about in recent times, we've had some of the papers that came out, with talking about challenges with disparities in telemedicine. And with telemedicine, we've, you know, some of the data suggests is that, you know, racial disparities among others may actually, you know, be, you know, more prominent, and they may come more to the forefront because disparate utilization of telemedicine. So I wanted to, you know, pose this question to the panel. How do you think we can tackle this, you know, going forward with more, you know, telemedicine implementations?
Well, Gagan, I think that I definitely agree that what you're, the premise of your question is that I think this pandemic has really showed us and surprised a lot of people about the extent to which we still have healthcare disparities in 2021 in the United States. And it really, and I think to follow on that, you know, we have all this amazing technology, and it's really not quite that useful if it can't, you know, get to the people who need it the most. So I think that the premise of your question, and I hope that the premise of your question is that the technology can be widening the gap. And I guess I have a simple answer, which is that I hope that our community can figure out ways that we can use technology to narrow that gap instead of widening it. Now, how are we going to do that? I don't, you know, this is a wider problem in society. Like, is wireless computing, you know, narrowing or widening that gap? You know, we have to work on this. And I hope there can be ways that we can do that. Now, I don't, you know, we got to get technology in a way that's easy for people to use and intuitive for them. And maybe that's going to mean, you know, working with drugstores to get devices in there for screening or, you know, patient management. Yeah, I think it's going to be, you know, Ted mentioned earlier the concept of screening, I think, for diabetes and glaucoma using telemedicine. And, you know, I think one legitimate question is, you know, what is the goal of telemedicine? Is it going to be to screen for patients? In other words, identify whether they have the disease and get you to where you need to go? Or is it going to be to remotely manage people? In other words, you know, we know you have this disease, let's take care of you and deliver that care remotely. And so bottom line is that I really think that it's going to be important to recognize that and to come up with sort of, I guess, use cases for how technology can help narrow that gap.
Yeah, I think, thank you for sharing that, Dr. Chang. I wanted to just give the chance to other panelists to also reflect on you know, what Dr. Chang said.
I totally agree. I think we first have to recognize the given patient-specific factors that could lead to digital exclusion, and, you know, recognizing that is the first step, and then doing, you know, specific interventions to target those areas. I'm going to plug a paper that we have coming out in the next month, where we rolled out home vision monitoring at Moorfields again to around 500 patients and tried to assess for enablers and barriers to deployment and risk factors for digital exclusion in these patients. And we had our preconceived notions of what would be the risk factors and barriers to smartphone-based home vision monitoring. And actually, we were a little bit surprised in that the biggest barriers that we found were related to age, vision in the better seeing eye, and education level, which was kind of predisposed, or we had a preconceived notion of that, but at least ethnicity, sex, and English as a first language were not associated with barriers to smartphone-based home vision monitoring. I think more studies are obviously needed to try to recognize these barriers to digital exclusion, you know, and every care paradigm and every way that these technologies are rolled out will have its own intrinsic potentials for being a barrier to the different demographics that it serves. So I think we definitely need to first identify them and then target it, whether it's education or interventions to address each of those risk factors.
Gagan, can I just follow up on what Eddie said? Those were great comments, I thought, and I really have enjoyed following the work that you've done, especially with the, you know, UK group, and I look forward to seeing that paper. The point that I thought that Eddie made that was really important is that there's been a lot of recognition in, you know, recent years about the impact of social determinants of health
and, you know, why are patients going blind from preventable vision loss, you know, in 2021? And, you know, is it education, transportation, you know, lack of computing resource? And if any of you are really interested in this, I think that what, you know, one step following on what Eddie said is really finding some experts in things like social determinants of health and melding the technology with the social science and, you know, figure out how can we bridge those gaps that Eddie is talking about. And within the ophthalmology community, there's a couple people who are, you know, starting to do some, I think, really nice work in the area. You know, Kristen Nwanyewu is at Yale, Angela Elam is at the University of Michigan, and there's someone, Orice Knight, at the University of North Carolina, I think. And you may want to talk to some people like that and just try to identify what these, you know, again, how to bridge technology and, you know, what I'd call social science.
Those are incredible thoughts. Thank you for sharing those. And of course, you can comment whenever, Dr. Chang. So I noticed Dr. Lang just texted me that his voice, for some reason, his audio is not working. And he tried to respond in between and it was not coming through. Dr. Lang, do you want to try now?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I was having maybe a Bluetooth issue at some point, and I actually missed most of Eddie's response. So maybe I'll be saying similar stuff, but I think, you know, as we look at healthcare disparities, there are a few things we can do is as we try to deploy our new technologies and innovations, we need to be very mindful as to where we're putting these technologies and really be intentional as far as actually seeking out these communities that are not getting the healthcare, and the gap is widening as we deploy these technologies. The other point I'd made earlier, which no one heard, was that, you know, we need to seek out members of these communities to join our teams and really include them in the conversation, and also make that an intentional goal as we start to, you know, develop ideas and build products and do trials. And I think the last point is also to look at the types of technologies that are available in underserved communities, both in the United States and worldwide. For example, people might not have access to a physician, a clinic, or even Wi-Fi or reliable internet service, but oftentimes they will have mobile devices and cell phones. And so, you know, I think that's why one of my focuses in my work has been to leverage mobile technology to reach more people. So I'll leave it at that. I'm sure other people have said other similar things.
Those are all great points. Thanks a lot, Dr. Lang, for bringing forward. I'm glad your audio is back to working again. With that, I think we conclude our second theme. What exciting that we still have good. We are running good on time. So with that, I'll pass it to Mike, and Mike can then, you know, reset the room and start the next thing.
Perfect. Thanks, Gogan. Yeah. So to reset the room, everyone, this is IT. And we're talking about evolution of ophthalmic telemedicine with Drs. Michael Chang, Ted Lang, and Edward Cora. I will move on to our third theme, which is about inspiring the next generation of trainees and ophthalmologists. And specifically, my question is, what are ways that early career researchers and clinicians can participate and contribute meaningfully in this field? Should clinicians be expected to gain proficiency in telemedicine development at an early stage, whether it be in medical school, during residency, and will they remain end users of the technology? So a bit of a loaded question, but I think we're in good company to help tackle this question. So if I can pass the mic to the panel. Thank you.
I can get a go as the youngest, most junior guy here. So, you know, I think, and I'm probably biased, but, you know, the young generation is definitely poised to drive the adoption of a lot of these technologies. You know, they grew up with these technologies, that are interacting with them on a daily basis. They're kind of born with a smartphone in their hand. And I mentioned before one of the big barriers, I think, is just the status quo. You know, after we have the proper validation and approvals and models of rollout, it's not a guarantee that these technologies will actually make it to the end users and to helping the patients. And that's what we all care about. And so I think it's super important that med schools and training programs integrate these technologies into their training. And right now there's not a really well-developed curriculum for that, but there's a lot of good materials on things like Coursera and Udemy, courses on digital health. And
I think it's the onus is kind of on us to develop that those curriculums and make sure that they're presented early, because that'll be a big part of how these actually get implemented.
I think my piece of advice for all aspiring folks on the line here is that, you know, you should seek out connections and opportunities, and it doesn't matter what stage of training you're in. Know that just, you know, being energetic and having a, you know, inquisitiveness and curiosity and an interest in participating in the conversation is a great starting point. You know, I got on this program today because Gagan, you know, came up to me at a meeting in Texas 3 weeks ago to introduce himself and say that he had been reading a few of my papers and he was interested in this topic. And I think, you know, as like my individuals, we naturally had a great connection and that just started it. So, you know, I think I actually tell this to a lot of our younger trainees, whether they're medical students or residents or fellows. I think early on in your career, when you go to academic meetings, whether that's the academy meeting or ARVO or any other number of meetings you might attend, you know, I think the natural inclination is to treat it like a vacation where you're, you know, you're out of your work environment, you're going out to dinners and social events, and you often try to gravitate towards your friends who might be at those events and spend time with them. But I think later on in your career, those meetings are actually crucial opportunities to network and make connections with potential collaborators, partners, and people that you actually want to do some work with. And while it is fun to catch up with old friends at these meetings, I think it's, you know, these are great opportunities to actually reach out to people that you want to associate yourself with and maybe potentially work with. So I think, you know, in addition to scheduling some social activities at these meetings, you know, try to see if there's people that might be at the meeting that you really would want to connect with there.
Thanks. And I'll also plug the free version of LinkedIn where you can do a trial and reach out to anybody. It's very helpful if you know who you want to reach out to. I think it gives you 7 days and it lets you message anybody out there.
You know, I guess I'll follow on what Eddie and Ted said. One thing that Eddie mentioned is this issue of integrating technology into training. And I think that's extremely important. You know, for a while, I've sort of been reflecting on, you know, this question, what is the one tool that every single physician in this country uses? And, you know, most people would say, well, maybe it's a stethoscope, or, you know, some people would say it's an ophthalmoscope if you're an ophthalmologist, but, you know, there are plenty of ophthalmologists who don't use ophthalmoscopes regularly. And so I think that one device is the computer, and that you sort of can't get around that. And despite that, I think there's a huge disconnect in medical education. You know, people will spend months, or years learning to auscultate or, you know, take a history. And, you know, in general, in medical school, people get zero formal education how to integrate computing technology into their practices. Yet this is the foundation of medical care in the 21st century. And so I hope, Eddie, I really agree with that. And maybe, you know, I don't know what the Stanford curriculum is like, but I mean, you and Ted are in a part of the country that really, you know, could be innovating in curricula and getting it out to the rest of the, you know, the country. And I also agree. I think both Eddie and Ted mentioned this aversion to change. And I guess the way that I would phrase that as an opportunity is that I definitely agree that, you know, the younger generation is probably more forward thinking and, you know, less risk averse, and you're going to have great ideas like this. And it's hard, you know, when you're the lower or the lowest person on the totem pole to make change with those great ideas though. But my suggestion would be, sort of riffing off what Ted said, to get close to some of the older people who are the decision makers and sort of convince them of what you're doing, or work with them on what you're doing, or do it together. In other words, if you can make them believers, and they'll get out there and convince their friends or talk to their friends about this, I actually think that's one of the ways that, you know, we can make substantive change. Because, you know, when you're the 30 or 40 year old something talking at a meeting, you know, people will tend to not believe you the same way as if you can convince the so-called thought leader to be talking about that. And the last thing I would say in terms of, I guess, research advice, I think that there's a lot of ways you can carve academic careers out of this, and telehealth in particular. You know, one of the underlying, I mean, the way that most of these telehealth studies are designed is you'll set up a telehealth system and you'll compare it to the real eye exam, you know, where the real eye exam is the gold standard. And one of the things that foiled a lot of my own research studies is the recognition that the gold standard is not really a very good gold standard. You know, there's a lot of variability among physicians in terms of the way that, you know, they'll diagnose, for example. And, you know, my small piece of the world academically was ROP, and we found enormous variabilities. You know, it, for example, diagnosing PLUS disease in ROP, very foundational, we found like a 6-to-1 ratio in terms of, you know, how frequently people diagnose it when they look at the exact same image. And if you get the world experts, it's that 6-to-1 ratio, because we pulled all the world experts on this. And when I go back and look at the literature, you know, which is not always that easy to gather, I actually think that that's, you know, there's good evidence in glaucoma, you know, diabetic, you know, looking at the optic disc, you know, diagnosing diabetic retinopathy. And so I think that that raised a lot of questions in terms of, you know, how do you validate these systems? What is sort of the gold standard? And, you know, if any of you are interested in that, I hope you take a careful look at, you know, how good we're doing ophthalmic diagnosis in 2021 and how we can make it better, and how telemedicine or telemedicine plus AI can make that better. Because I think there's a lot of room for innovation here.
Well, from one mic to another, Dr. Chang, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And to your earlier points that you made, and Dr. I mean, just from the AAO meeting that I was at a few days ago, just to see how open mentors were to trainees and listening to their ideas, it really just speaks to how the ball really is in our court, and to really sell you on an idea and to push the field forward. So thank you for those words. And now I'll move the mic back to Kat, and she can ask her next question.
Thank you. And yeah, thank you, Dr. Chang, for being so supportive of this platform as well. I think we've been fortunate to have leaders like yourself. Pierce Keane was here not too long ago, and then Aaron Lee. So given that there are so many programming languages out there, speaking of medical training, are there certain coding languages that may be advantageous for trainees and clinicians to help improve the medical care that they can start learning? I'll pose that to everyone.
I guess I'll start briefly. Brief answer to that. I think, you know, if you are kind of a scientist, I think learning MATLAB is really, you know, will get you far in doing things in a lab. And then of course with machine learning and stuff, Python is also a great language to get familiar with. And while we don't all have to become, you know, the top of our game in these languages, I think learning how to structure them is useful in being able to have conversations with people that are collaborating with you.
Catherine, I think that, yeah, I would agree with Ted that these days what's in vogue for programming and analytics are Python and R. If I were to look back, you know, when I was training in informatics, Perl, you know, was one of the languages that was in vogue. And when I trained originally, it was C that was what was common. And I guess what I would say from that is that, you know, they tell everyone on the first day of medical school, which I remember hearing, that half of what you learn is going to be obsolete, you know, by the time you practice. And I never believed that on the first day, but it's completely true. With that, you know, in the medicine world, my medical retina education was based on the macular photocoagulation study, which became obsolete 5 to 10 years after I went into practice because of anti-VEGF. And today's retina fellows, the ones that I've talked to, you never even heard of the MPS, let alone like know what it says or what I used to do back in, you know, 2000. And so the point that I want to make with that is that, you know, what's in vogue, you know, one thing that I've sort of, an epiphany that I had was that, you know, what's in vogue changes so quickly, both in medicine and in computing, that I think that, you know, those of you who are young will be well served by building a good foundation and sort of learning how to learn and getting that flexibility, you know, as Eddie said, to take in new ideas and sort of not be stuck with, you know, what was in vogue in 2021 when you started, you know, tackling something. Because I've sort of, you know, you don't really want to be at the top of your game in 2021. You're going to be better posed to develop the skills to be at the top of your game in 2030, you know, or 2040, you know, when you're in that important phase of your career. And so, you know, for computing, I think what that really means is, yeah, it's great to learn R and Python in 2021, but what you really want to do is understand good principles of coding, or, you know how to keep track of what's, you know, what's really being used when you need to use it, and just, you know, become an expert at that when you need to.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point that Mike made. I think I read this really great book recently called Range by David Epstein. I don't know if anyone else has read it, but, you know, one of the main messages of that book was that people who are successful actually are generalists and not specialists. So, you know, the story of, you know, the Tiger Woods or whatever doing the 10,000 hours of practice to become the best golfer in the world, or actually less the main road to success than, and more of an anomaly. And actually most successful people actually dabble in a lot of different things over time and gain a large range of skills. And so I would encourage all of you to do the same, to pick up different areas of science and medicine and actually non-science topics too, so you can think outside the box.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on that. I think it's great points. First of all, I think that, you know, there's a lot of great resources out there to be in the know of kind of what the cutting edge is. You know, there's newsletters like Dr. Penguin and others that basically do the work for you. That will give you a great synopsis of new machine learning papers inside and outside of medicine. And just being able to read those and comprehend what they're saying and what the different techniques they're using, and not necessarily to code that. And you're never going to be as good of a coder as the person that went to MIT to do it and is now at Google writing their new machine learning code. And you just have to be able to speak the language and to know where the biases can come in, that, you know, to look out for what best practices are, like Dr. Chang said, and to be able to adapt as things do change. And I think one of the good things is that new technologies tend to become more and more productionalized. So what took, you know, writing very low level code before, designing neural networks ground up, there's now big libraries that basically can be used, transfer learning that can be used. And now even newer, you know, we have these platforms that enable automated machine learning, which I've been doing a lot of work on, where essentially you don't need to code and you have a drag and drop user interface. They're publicly available. As long as you know good practices with data set management and cleaning the data and being able to identify implicit biases and what you want to predict for and to make sure it's a relevant use case, clinicians can go on these productionalized platforms and design their own machine learning models now. So that's just one example, and that's without coding. And that's just one example of things becoming more and more productionalized as time goes on. So just being in the know and being able to dive deep, but not too deep, but being able to talk to the people that are really good at their own fields that can help you out through collaboration is I think really, really important.
Those are all great points. And thank you so much for sharing those tips for the younger people in the room. And for myself, being super inspired by you guys and trying to, you know, make a difference in this field. With that, I'll pass it back to Kathryn and give her a chance to ask her question.
Thanks, Gagan. As a former Silicon Valley native, it was not uncommon to hear about new tech accelerators and hackathons occurring to help solve problems in society. Do you see this sort of hackathon approach ever making its way into academia so that we can accelerate the rate of innovation and discovery? And with that, how can we ensure that the highest privacy and safety measures are being met while we're innovating?
Well, I'll start with that. You know, we at being at Stanford, there are still hackathons going on here every year, and they're actually really great kind of launch pads, I think, for innovation, because it brings
first of all, it brings like-minded individuals together into a room, and they can be people from medicine, science, engineering, business. And, you know, I actually encourage our trainees that come through the program here, if they're interested at all in this type of environment, to join one of the hackathons that are going on. And while you're trying to create a prototype in 2 days or one day at these things, obviously you can't create a whole business or company off of it in that time. But what it does do is that it actually accelerates the idea formulation stage and allows you to form teams that can lead to real things in the world.
Yeah, I'll add to that, Ted, that I really like the premise. And let me add a different twist to it, which is that, you know, one of the things I would love to see is the best people going into the vision field. Because as an engineer, you've got a lot of options. You know, you can go work at Google or wherever else. And, you know, I would love if we can get the best technology people to do research in medicine, specifically in vision. Of course, it's, you know, self-serving for all of us. And I think one of the ways that we do that is by providing the best data, because the best technologists are going to gravitate to where the best data are. And what that really means is that it's incumbent upon our field to collect the best data sets. And that's probably going to be through sharing data. And then we get the best engineers from Palo Alto or Boston or wherever they come from to learn about vision and, you know, how we solve really important problems like curing blindness.
I was just going to say, I totally agree. You know, the deltas and the best performing models are typically around the data and the labeling at this point. And a lot of the models, you know, don't perform as well when they're in the real world. And where is all the real world data? It's, you know, it's in the clinics. And so I think we're well poised as clinicians to be able to work with people to really meaningfully evaluate the real world use scenarios of models. And going back to the hackathon question, yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a great way to spur innovation in a short time period. But I also think that it's important to set the directions and the goals of those hackathons in very meaningful ways. And I think, again, clinicians are best poised to identify the relevant use cases for their patients and to be the ones that will set those use cases and goals. And so that way we can orient a hackathon around a particular standard or a particular reason to exist that will actually hopefully translate into the real world.
Thank you, Dr. Kuro, for those insightful words. With that being said, I just wanted to plug our talk that's happening in 2 weeks from now, which will be on December 4th at the same time, focusing on the evolution of ocular oncology and careers in the field, where we'll be joined by Drs. Prithvi Murugunjaya, Carol Karp, and Basil Williams. It promises to be an exciting talk ranging from uveal melanoma genetics to advances in the treatment of OSSN. So we'd love you all to join us. So that will be December 4th from 12 to 1 p.m.
And with that, I think I would love to thank our panelists for being so patient and being here for the whole thing. And Dr. Chang, thanks for making time. And Dr. Lang, thanks for being here. Dr. Kuro, it was a pleasure having you too. So I would love to see if you guys had any closing remarks.
Just thanks for having us on. This is a really great forum and format, and it was really fun to participate. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Thank you guys. Appreciate it. And let me know if there's any questions or if anyone wants access to any of the resources that I mentioned.
Yeah, I would say thank you as well. Had a great time. It was good to hear all of you.
If you want more IT related content, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at IT official. EYETEA. IT.